So I'll just briefly pass you over to Stephen Smith, who's a UKCP registered integrative psychotherapist.
Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me okay?
No?
Closer?
Closer. Yes? Okay. When Ruth asked us to imagine the humanistic and the analytic side by side in the exercise, my process was very much reconfirming where I am. I see myself as a humanistic integrative psychotherapist and a student of Jung and the post-Jungians. And I have to say, it's delightful to be an eternal student. Just a brief background. I trained at Metanoia in integrative psychotherapy from 1997 to 2002. That was quite life-changing for me. And when I qualified, I was asked to join the team, so I actually teach on the Masters in integrative psychotherapy. Shortly after qualifying, I found myself trotting off to a wonderful place, the Psychosynthesis Education Trust, to train in supervision, which I absolutely loved and lapped up. During that time, I was in therapy weekly. I had 7 years with my therapist, and she was humanistic and also had been trained in Jungian psychology. The first session, she said to me, "I'd like you to lie on the couch," to which I said, "You've got no chance. I need to see you." Which says a lot about my childhood, I'm sure. What she did do after many years, she'd do this very strange posture, which the first time was quite hilarious. She'd suddenly go... The first time she did it, I thought, oh my God, she's fallen asleep, and sat quietly. Then I thought, oh God, what if she's had a stroke? And the minutes went on. And then suddenly she went, "I am listening." I went, "Oh, right." And she would do that quite often. What led me to the Jungian psychology course at the Center for Psychoanalytic Studies was a most powerful and moving dream for me, which I took to my therapist. In the dream, there were three beds. I am a bisexual man. And on the three beds, there was me on one bed with another man, having a great time. There was me on the other bed with a woman, having a great time. And then I walked into the room, dressed in a priest's cassock, and laid down in the middle bed. It was so, I felt so integrated, confirmed. I was deeply moved. And I shared this with her. And she had her head down, of course. And suddenly she looked up and she was crying. And just as the dream had confirmed me, she confirmed me in her response. And then she said, "I have something to say to you. You've just had a most wonderful coniunctio." And I thought, I've never heard of that sexual practice before. In fact, I actually said, "A whatty?" That was the kernel that led me to the Centre for Psychoanalytic Studies, to study Jung. And interestingly, I'm currently studying at John Moores University in the transpersonal department. And my research, I've just finished completing interviewing 23 clergy from the Church of England who identify as heterosexual, bisexual, homosexual, lesbian and transgendered. I was privileged to meet two transgendered Church of England clergy who are very well accepted by their congregations, mm-hmm. who were once men and now are women. But now I've got the head-banging time of analysing the data and writing 84,000 words of yay. So to my topic at hand, in recent decades it would be fair to say there has been the rise of the relational in the psychotherapies. It's become more and more prolific within traditional psychoanalytic thinking, and also within the humanistic traditions, it's been recalibrated. I mention you in a minute. Within the American context, relational psychoanalysis and intersubjectivity have dominated recent theorizing and practice. The wonderful work of Martha Stark, who's a relational psychoanalyst, terms this way of working as a two-person psychology. This two-person psychology, or relational approach to psychoanalysis, asserts, and I quote from Martha, that what heals the patient is neither insight nor a corrective experience. Rather, what heals is interactive engagement with an authentic other. What heals is the therapeutic relationship itself. Now, coming from a formally trained psychoanalyst, that's a huge shift from where she would normally have pitched herself in the therapeutic endeavour. Now, there are significant differences, which don't concern us in this talk, between relational psychoanalysis and intersubjectivity. However, what they do share are concepts like, which our speakers have also mentioned, mutuality, reciprocity, the interactive dyad, a bi-directional understanding of the relationship, and key concept of enactment, not acting out, but an enactment. In other words, at an unconscious level, they argue, the patient puts pressure on the analyst to reenact an earlier wound. And in that moment, the analyst becomes the bad object. By working through it in a non-defensive, dialogical way, the therapist can eventually be the bad object that comes good, which of course heals the present moment and heals the child within. So it's about co-createdness. Now, long before this paradigm shift gained momentum within the psychoanalytic field, of course, the humanistic psychotherapies in the mid-20th century onwards prized the relationship above all. They see the therapeutic relationship as the primary vehicle for change, growth and healing. For our purposes, these humanistic psychotherapies, namely the person-centered approach, Gestalt, and transactional analysis, have also recalibrated the relational aspect of their work. So, for instance, from the person-centered approach in 2005, Means and Cooper write about relational depth. A quote from them. Relational depth, a state of profound contact between two people in which each person is fully real with the other and able to understand and value the other's experience at a high level. Gestalt too has recalibrated this relational impetus. You mentioned Heisner and Jacobson particularly. A quote from them, from Gestalt. Dialogical psychotherapy is defined primarily by an approach, attitude, or stance towards human existence in general, and the process of psychotherapy in particular. By its very nature, it is always an ongoing process, requiring unique responses to unique situations. At the heart of this approach is the belief that the ultimate basis of our existence is relational or dialogic in nature. We are all threads in our interhuman fabric. And Hargadon and Sills, in 2001, of course, they recalibrated as a new school within TA, the relational transactional analysis approach. Collectively, within psychoanalysis and within the humanistic psychotherapies, what's been underscored is that we are not an isolated mind, as perhaps Freud insisted in his earlier work. Rather, we are interconnected in a web of relatedness. What comes to mind here immediately is Jung's idea of the collective unconscious, of course. a pause for thought and a drink. With this relational tide, are we in danger of overlooking the ontological component that plays an equally significant role in the psychotherapeutic process of change, particularly as this relates to the client and indeed the therapist? Ontology is a branch of metaphysics that is devoted and concerned with the nature of being. At this point, I wish to explore the critical connections from the past. Having looked at now the current relational field, I want to now go back to the past as I critically evaluate these ideas, to perhaps reclaim, particularly from Jungian analysis, and importantly, from the person-centered approach, Gestalt and TA, ideas that attest to the innate potential and possibility for change, growth and healing that the client already has, that potentially could become the shadow in our obsession with the relational. Are you with me so far? Have I lost you? No? Okay, thank you. In the collected works of Book 5, Carl Jung provides us with a very detailed definition of his concept of enantiodromia. I quote, "Every psychological extreme secretly contains its own opposites or stands in some sort of intimate or essential relation to it. Indeed, it is from this tension that it derives its own peculiar dynamism. This is no hallowed custom that cannot on occasion turn into its opposite, and the more extreme a position is, the more easily may we expect an enantiodromia, a conversion of something into its opposite." At this point, of course, he thinks of St. Paul, St. Paul's conversion, who is persecuting the Christians, and then suddenly this enantiodromia happens within his old being, and then he becomes one of the most key writers about the Christian message. Simply put, enantiodromia means running counter to. And of course, he borrows this idea from the Greek philosopher Heraclitus. My understanding of the aim of the Jungian analyst is to occupy what we call the transcendent function within the analytic enterprise. By transcendent, I don't mean spiritual, but rather the analyst in their role as the transcendent function is, with compassion, listening to the unconscious messages and linking this with the patient's conscious material. In a sense, they are an important bridge to open up greater dialogue with the God image, the self, with the ego, that will then shape that person's individuation process, their unique journey to be fully themselves. When I think about the enantiodromia within the humanistic psychotherapies, I'm very interested in some very similar concepts. As an integrative psychotherapist, I was taught not to reify theory. I agree with a comment made earlier. For me, theory is psychobiography. It stems out of someone's lived experience, rather than theory being fact or truth or the truth. So I'm always holding these concepts lightly. At its best, I think theory captures human experience, and some theories speak to us and some theories don't. So as I move on to look at the humanistic psychotherapies to look for connections between the enantiodromia, this inbuilt ontological dynamic that can kick in and make someone shift to a very different polarity. Of course, within the person-centered approach, which is going to be covered much more detail later, just briefly, Rogers' idea of the self-actualizing tendency is an ontological concept in itself, that innately the client has this energy, this possibility, this potential. But of course, what is needed from the counsellor is an embodied working with the core conditions, empathy, unconditional positive regard, incongruence. These are key in the environment to open up the self-actualizing tendency. So there we have the relationship and we have the ontology held in some creative tension. I love Arnold Besser. Has anybody heard of Arnold Besser? He's a lovely man. His key paper was in 1970. Outside of Fritz Perls' corpus of work, he's the most quoted with his concept of the paradoxical nature of change. It's a lovely concept. A quote from that 1970 paper that he wrote. Briefly stated, it is this: that change occurs when one becomes what he is, not when he tries to become what he is not. By rejecting the role of change agent, we make meaningful and orderly change possible. You can see the resonance immediately with an antiodromia. Yeah. There is a trust in an inner dynamic. Yeah. And then enters into this lovely thinking, the posture or the how the therapist positions themselves in the relationship. And it's from a gentleman, and I'll try my best, like you with hard words, but I can't say them. Solomo Friedländer, in 1918, devised a concept called creative indifference. It's a lovely concept. To be creatively indifferent. What he means by that is that, in conjunction with the ideas of Besser, that the idea of the therapist is to sit between the two polarities and not try to coerce or urge or push the client to be where you think they should be, but rather to be really present with creative indifference. In other words, holding the middle ground and dialoguing with the client. Again, you can see a similarity with the idea of the analyst taking the transcendent function, making a bridge, being a bridge between the two. And likewise, with the paradoxical nature of change, the therapist, with their creative indifference, is acting as a bridge. And of course, if we think of transactional analysis, again, Eric Byrne borrows from Heraclitus, the whole notion of physis. Briefly put, physis is the belief that every living thing has the innate drive towards change, growth and healing. So if I, in my madness, went and put a concrete slab on a plant in my garden, we would think, that's it, it's dead. But actually, the physis would make the enfeebled plant work its way to the edge of the concrete slab and then grow, albeit more enfeebled, but the drive towards change, growth and healing is not completely obliterated. Again, you can see the resonance with Jung's idea of enantiodromia. But for me, Jung has something quite distinct to say in comparison to the humanistic ideas of the ontological part in change. There's a lot in common, but I think he has something very distinct to say. And then I will just end with a very brief clinical vignette to hopefully show my thinking and his thinking, most importantly. In the Collected Works, Book 9, he writes this: I must emphasize, however, that the grand plan on which the unconscious life of the psyche is constructed is so inaccessible to our understanding that we can never know what evil may be necessary in order to produce good. by enantiodromia, and, indeed, what good may very possibly lead to evil. A case in point, I'm making, obviously, so these names up anonymously. My client, James, from Austria, a man of 38, he worked with me for 5.5 years. He worked in the financial sector, and his pattern would be he would go to work Monday to Friday, he'd be in at 7, he'd leave at 10. And of course, we know in some cultures in the banking world, this kind of behaviour is very much encouraged. It's not challenged. He'd then go in on a Saturday. 9 o'clock, that was a lie-in for him. And then he'd leave at 9. Then he'd find himself going to prostitutes. So when he came to me, he was highly suicidal. And what was uncovered eventually was that his mother was so driven for him to be a good boy and to be special and to be the best that she would ring his school and say, James is very sick this week, he can't come to school. He would then sit at his desk from 8 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock at night as a young child, and she would stand over him, bring him drinks and food, and tell him to study and to work hard. So you can see how that transposed over into the banking world very easily. His dad hung himself when he was 18, and he came back from university to clear up the mess, because mum couldn't do it. He was quite brutalised, and in some ways there was a real psychic inflation of narcissism covering up the terrible fragmentation and neglect and trauma. Now, he expected me to admonish him for seeing the prostitutes and to be disgusted. In a sense, transferentially, he was almost trying to provoke me to be his mother, that he must be a good boy. But thinking of enantiodromia, I had a sense that this, while dangerous, could be the route to him getting balanced and well. On one occasion, which was very distressing, after he went, I actually cried. I think he went like this, and he went, look, I'm crying. He didn't know how to cry. It was really distressing when he'd gone, because I really felt his pain of not being mirrored, not being seen. Gradually, he'd come in and say, I haven't seen the prostitutes this week. And I'd go, right. So they hooked in. And then, of course, the week after he would. This escalated. And on one occasion, he went to the Westminster Bridge and was about to throw himself off. And thankfully, rang me. And thankfully, a client had cancelled, and I picked the phone up and talked him out of it. Eventually, his behaviour, he'd go and hire escort agents. Women would come. He was quite abusive to them, exploitative. He would knock them down on their price. So this really dark stuff started to emerge. Exploitative, abusive, disrespectful. All the things he'd learned. But of course, he was so ashamed and couldn't face himself. And then, eventually, there was this enantiodromia. And he got into a relationship, a real relationship with another woman, and began to love and laugh and cry again. So maybe we need to be careful that the relational term is a term too far. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for a wonderful talk, Stephen.
Thank you.
We just have a little time for questions.
Deirdre Hatzler, if anything, I'm an integral therapist, but I don't like labels. Can you hear now?
Yes.
I'm an integral psychotherapist, aka Wilbur, Ken Wilbur. What I wonder was, how did you cope with your own feelings when he was coming in with all these stories?
Damn good supervision. Thankfully, my wife is a therapist, so occasionally, obviously with high anonymity, I might share something if it was too troubling. I did sometimes have nightmares after he'd gone, so I was quite deeply affected. And of course, the impetus for me was to get busy. That was the relational piece. And I thought, no, you've got to trust this. It's a risky business, of course, and I was quite fretful for it. But I just sensed from somewhere deeper that even though this behaviour was getting quite dangerous, I just sensed it would be a bridge to him to becoming more human and actually risking sexuality and emotions in a good, supportive relationship. And thankfully, he did get that. Mm.
Keith Sylvester, integrative psychosynthesis therapist. I'm just wondering about the playing with extremes, because I've always been what I would say a more happy medium person. And I know this goes back to my psychosynthesis fundamentals. So I said, won't it make me a boring person if I'm not full of extremes? I'm just wondering what the link is between working through the extremes and creativity is. And are people who follow more the happy medium, are they dull, boring, non-neurotic?
Well, judging by your shirt, certainly not. It's a yes from me. I think it's a really good point. And of course, for me, as an integrative, it's not an arrival, it is a process. It's a living thing. It's never a conclusion. And it is about holding the polarities and living at the centre of our polarities. But I do think, Keith, sometimes people have to go to the absolute opposite polarity, the enantiodromia, in order to come back and find their middle point, which can be risky. And when it works, it's thrilling to see. Thank you, Keith.
I can't see any hands.
Oh, Deirdre, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. I loved your correction to our sort of Belsen Schaum or whatever you would call it. I just wondered, in terms of relationship to the inner objective world, because that's another thing. Those things that exist in our unconscious that are objective, which we actually have to relate to. Mm. And for me, that adds something that's still relational about your description of ontology.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, it's just an added...
Yes, no, of course it's all about relationship. But I think I get a bit alarmed when I hear comments, but of course everything's just co-created. Well, it's not actually. Mm-hmm. There are real essences about people that they are, in typology, people come into the world with a particular emotional timber that may not even have anything to do with the parents or the family. So when I hear, oh, everything's co-created, I go, hang on a minute, in part, but also it's about discovering things about each other, both in our conscious world and through our unconscious communication.
Yeah, Andrew Samuels, can I just say that I'm very glad you've done this paper, because I do think that what's got lost in the stress on the therapy relationship and relationality is the prime role of the client. And I think that is there in Jung, and it's there in early Rogers, and it's come back with our Bohart, the active client, and all that kind of thing. And the research is fascinating. Top qualitative psychotherapy researchers like Michael Lambert, John Norcross, they say, if you think it's the therapy relationship that's doing the business, dream on, okay? Aside from the fact that 40% of what happens, nobody knows why, the single biggest variable is the client or where she is. And I think, I took that from your ontology, actually. The beingness of the individual, and I think that's what you're on as well, Doctor, you know, is something that's there in our history that has been swept away with the turn of psychotherapy into a communication field, which I think loses something very valuable, which is what I heard you to be saying.
Yeah. And I think what I really like about Besser, for instance, in 1970, is really emphasising that you need to meet somebody in their human beingness as another human being, not try to get them somewhere. And once they feel fully met as they are, they will shift.
Fantastic. I think this is a good place to stop for tea. Thank you, Stephen. To our day, and we'll reconvene at 12:15.